Hey, y'all, how's it going? Oh, yeah, that's good. All right, well, welcome to my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. Like, here's a who. Honest 100% and all that stuff. ScottHorton.org is the website. If you want to check out the interview archives there, 3,900 and something of them. Going back to 2003 there at ScottHorton.org. And then, you know, there's some other stuff on there. Like the chat room. Join up the chat room. Hey, where the hell is everybody? I mean, some people are there. Hey, people who are there. But where the hell's everybody else? Well, I suppose they'll be here soon. ScottHorton.org/chat. Fake name and a captcha, and you're in there. Also, it's a IRC free node chat. If you like IRC free node chats, it's hashtag Scott Horton Show. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show as well. All right. You can tweet me things. Tomorrow, MJ Rosenberg is going to be on the show to talk about AIPAC after their humiliating defeat on the Iran deal issue and what we can expect from the Israel lobby in the near term anyway. So that should be good. Here in a little while, we're going to have Chris Woods back on the show to talk about coalition strikes and civilian casualty claims in Iraq and Syria for August. Keeping very close track of the airstrikes there. The great Chris Woods from airwars.org, formerly at the Bureau for Investigative Journalism, author of Sudden Justice. And I'm not sure why they left the ironic quotes off of the term justice in the title there, but yeah, you get it. All right, so that's coming up. And, and then there's this. The UN says the U.S. drone strikes in Yemen have killed more civilians than Al-Qaeda. So we're going to be talking with Chris all about that, too. All about the war in Yemen. Boy, isn't it amazing how there's just no coverage of it on TV, hardly at all? As far as I can tell. I heard a little bit on, it wasn't NPR, it was Public Radio International. They were doing some coverage of it, but as far as TV is concerned, there is no war on Yemen. And if there was, it would be, yeah, we're fighting Iran there. And what they really mean is we're fighting for Al-Qaeda there. Well, for and against them. Ow, man. Got to put my cheek. For them and against them at the same time. They are drone striking them. But they're also drone striking their enemies to much greater effect. Well, to a much greater extent, anyway. Guess it remains to be seen to what effect. All right. Bolda says LRN down. Oh, no, say it ain't so. Really? Man, that's not good. Am I really not on the radio right now? That would be a bummer. I'm thinking maybe it's just him. What has the problem? I guess I could try to pull it up on my phone. I really don't want to, though. Actually, I could do it just right down here, couldn't I? Yeah, I don't know. This link works, says Kits Mac. So I'm on there somewhere. All right. I'm on TuneIn. And I'm on... All right, chat room guys, they're taking care of each other there, so I don't need to bother. Yes, the show is on. That's good. Nice to know. Okay, tons of news to cover today. I'm glad I hardly have any guests. Actually, I'm waiting to hear back from a couple. But there's so much news to cover that... yeah, good. First of all... No, this goes lower on. The fighting at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem stretches into the third day. And, you know, I was trying to get a hold of... thanks, Bill. Got your email here. I was trying to get Ramzi Baroud on the show. Hang on. I got to whistle at my dog here real quick. Okay. So yeah, I was trying to think of a Palestinian that I could get on short notice to discuss this. And I know a few Palestinian guests, but none of them can do the show on short notice, including Ramsey. I guess I'm still hoping I'll hear back from him. But I don't even really know what's going on. I mean, I can tell you the broader context, but I can't tell you about the recent fighting. Who started it? Who's backing who? What role the IDF is playing in backing the settlers and which have you? Don't know. The larger context is the Israelis are stealing the city of Jerusalem, all of it. And the Al-Aqsa Mosque, of course, has been under the control of Muslims for the last, I don't know, what, 1,300 years or whatever. And it is the third holiest site in Islam. Supposedly, of course, it used to be Solomon's Temple back before, but it's supposedly where Muhammad ascended to heaven when he died, I think. And so, I guess according to international agreements, or just, you know, to avoid making matters that much worse, the Israeli government, which of course controls the entire area, and their military, have, I think for the most part, I don't know all the details, but they certainly control the area and they don't let Jewish settlers come in and do whatever they want. They have strict control on there, and it, for intents and purposes, still belongs to the Muslims there. Although, of course, the IDF is not on their side in any particular clash, I guess. But they're on their own side, you know what I mean? But anyway, so there have been... they say here the clashes continued on Tuesday. See, this is the New York Times, man. I had an Al Jazeera piece, but it was out of date. But let me see if I can find a recent Al Jazeera piece, because I don't even want to bother with the New York Times, because it's probably not right. This one is too far out of date. 3 days old here. 2 days old. Oh, hell. Israeli police storm Al-Aqsa Mosque for third day, it says. Let's read that one. Clashes erupt after Israeli police raid mosques' courtyards to support tours for Jewish activists. Palestinians and Israeli forces have clashed at Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque for a third day straight as Israeli forces were seen on the roof of the holy site. Suleiman Ahmad, the president of Jerusalem's affairs department, who was at the scene, told Al Jazeera that at least 36 Palestinians were injured in the clashes early on Tuesday. They have placed snipers on the rooftops and are using rubber bullets, Ahmad said. Well, that's kind of a relief. The site of the mosque is revered as holy by Jews and Muslims and is a frequent flashpoint of violence. And remember, this is how Ariel Sharon started the Second Intifada, deliberately, quite deliberately, by going to the Temple Mount, which is, you know, what the Jews call it. And Palestinians inside Al-Aqsa threw stones and fireworks. Oh, I always pronounce it wrong with the S before the Q, don't I? Well, what the hell? Nobody ever speaks Arabic around me. I don't know things. Palestinians inside Al-Aqsa threw stones and fireworks at the Israeli forces and set up barricades to prevent them from closing the entrance to the mosque. The police forces eventually closed the doors to the mosque with the Palestinians still inside. Al-Aqsa courtyard tours. Israeli police were trying to allow Jewish activists, meaning, I guess, right-wing settlers, to tour the courtyards of the mosque, which in the past has stirred angry reactions from Palestinians who fear Israel may change the rules for visiting the Al-Aqsa compound. Yosef Mukhamar, the head of the Al-Aqsa worshiper movement, told Al Jazeera that Muslim Palestinians were prohibited from entering the mosque to pray, while Israeli settlers are allowed to enter the mosque and roam around freely under police protection. Anyway, that promises to just get worse, and I promise to have coverage of it for you soon here. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, kids, welcome back. I'm Scott. This is my show here. All right, so a little bit of politics here. First of all, Rand continues to do terrible, just like he deserves. Secondly, look who's doing well. Trump, and I'm talking among the Republicans. Well, and among the Democrats, too, for that matter, we could talk about. Donald Trump, Ben Carson, and I don't think she's in third yet, but she's doing better and better all the time. Carly Fiorina. And why? Because they're not from D.C. That's it. That's the only thing about them is they're not governors or senators, which is supposed to be the rule. You can't be the president unless you're a governor or senator first, you know, 99% of the time. And, I don't know, 99, but most of the time. Anyway, so, there's this huge energy in the country for just whatever's going on up there. It's bad leadership. Now, you and me, we know that we don't need leadership. We just need freedom. But at least give people credit. They can tell that this ain't working. And yes, it's easy to demagogue and convince them to, you know, target the wrong enemies. But, you know, with their grudges and whatever, but still, at least they're angry. And just think of what Rand Paul could be doing right now. I mean, it's the slightest little hurdle to hop to say, yeah, I'm a senator, but let's get it right. You want to talk about outsider? Well, here's my Ron Paulian platform, and how do you like that? And he would at least be right up there in the top four. Maybe he'd be in fourth, but he'd be beating the rest of the politicians and would be up there with Trump and Cardin. I keep calling him Cardin. Cardin's the other guy. Carson. And Fiorina. I mean, yeah, I'm a senator, but I'm a freshman senator. I'm from Kentucky, and I just got here, and I'm Ron Paul's son, so obviously, you know. Let's talk about ending the empire. Let's talk about abolishing the IRS. Let's talk about gutting the state and setting the people of this nation free. Let's talk about that. And he'd be kicking ass right now. He'd be raging right now. And instead, he's playing the role of, I'm the most party man here. That Donald Trump, why, he's hardly loyal to the Republican Party at all. Yeah, well, neither are the Republican Party's voters at this point. That's why they renamed themselves the Tea Party there for a while. Because they hate their bosses. Those are the people who elected Rand Paul to the Senate in the first place. Now he's running as, what was the guy's name, Trey Grayson or whatever? The establishment candidate that he beat in the primaries? Now that's who he's running as president, for president. And how's it working out? He's tied for last with everybody who already lost. He's down there with Chris Christie, the pathetic joke. And he deserves to be losing, too. I mean, here's this miscalculation. One, oh, I can move as far to the right and as close to the establishment as I want, and all my Ron Paul fans and legions, they'll all love me and follow me and let me get away with anything because they'll stupidly believe that, no, I secretly really am like them. Wrong. All the Ron Paulians abandoned him a long time ago. And then what was the rest of his calculation? But by sucking up to the establishment, then they'll love me. The neocons will love me. The right-wing Jacksonian rank-and-file you know, Ted Cruzian. Republican voters will love me, and they'll all give me power and make me the president. And how's that working out? He pushed away everyone who was dying to love him and support him, betrayed us all, in order to suck up to a bunch of people who have no interest in him whatsoever. And lie down on the floor again before Bill Kristol and promise him the moon. And they still all hate you, Rand. Just like we all do. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let the media hang Rand Paul around libertarianism's neck like some albatross. That's not libertarianism that's failing up there. That's not Ron Paul. That's his son. He's not one of us. He never was. Disgrace. And then here's the other thing. Ben Carson? Okay, maybe the guy's an accomplished neurosurgeon. You gotta give him credit for that. You gotta give credit to any man who can operate on another person's brain and then they don't die during the damn thing. Much less he's successful in actually helping them. Separating Siamese twins and these kinds of things. There's a brilliant genius in that guy's mind. But what a crank! Have you ever heard him talk? All the politics, I mean, I haven't watched all the speeches or anything, okay, I admit. But the one that did him so well, he just told his own personal story. But if you ever seen him on Fox News, he's a complete idiot when it comes to who should be bombed to death. He knows nothing about the world that he wants to kill. Nothing. He's like reading the comments section at the Weekly Standard. So, you know what? He knows about neurons what I wish I knew about neurons, man. Fine. But qualified to be the leader of the world empire? This clown? Are you serious? And again, hey, at least he's not a governor or a senator. He's a doctor, not a lawyer. That's what I used to say about Ron, right? I like that. But Jesus, would it kill you to read something? And anyway, the fact that he's in second place when he gives his stump speech and his stump speech is simply like, you know, his personal story of being a self-made man, which, by the way, makes Donald Trump look like a trust fund kid that he is. Self-made nothing compared to Ben Carson. But ask him to choose which side should we be killing and killing four in Syria. And the rest of these guys are all take the, you know, Israel first treason position that America should be backing the Mujahideen against the secular dictator. Does Ben Carson even know enough to get it that wrong? And he is killing the competition. He's right up there with Trump and everybody else far behind. Could be Rand. Could be Rand. It'd be so easy for Rand to do this. All he's got to do is just read his father's articles and accept that he, Rand, is stupid and wrong about everything. And so he should stop being himself, the lousy person that he is, and he should start pretending to be his dad out there. You know, have some courage and honesty.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. First guest today, I guess our only guest today is going to be our friend Chris Woods, author of Sudden Justice, and now at airwars.org. You can also find tons of his previous journalism at the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you?
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, very good. Very busy at the moment, as you can imagine, but good. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Well, there's lots of air wars going on, aren't there?
There are, and they seem to be multiplying by the week at the moment.
Yeah. Boy, I'm about to have to sneeze, so I'm going to turn it over to you. Tell us about this new report that you have here for the month of August.
So, yeah, at Air Wars, we've been putting together a monthly report looking into what the international coalition has been doing in Iraq and Syria. And the air war there continues to get more intense, as I'm sure your listeners know. Since August of 2014, this international coalition of 13 partners now has been attacking Islamic State across both countries. We're now told that more than 22,478 bombs and missiles have been dropped on Iraq and Syria, 6,500 airstrikes. The bulk of those, by the way, by the United States. We did the numbers for Syria. 99% of all of the airstrikes in Syria last month were by the US. They're not really a coalition there at all, Scott. Really, it's a unilateral conflict involving the US. Although we're told that Australia and friends are keen to get into that fight in the coming days. And, of course, the UK only recently carried out its first targeted assassination away from the battlefield. I mean, Syria is obviously a battlefield, but not for Britain. The British Parliament voted that the UK government couldn't carry out airstrikes in Syria without its express permission. The British government did that anyway. So lots going on. On the other side of that coin, we've got civilian casualties. These continue to mount. You wouldn't necessarily know it from reports in the US, but we logged 12 incidents of concern in August. Four of those were particularly worried about. One involved the deaths of seven children, including six little girls, sadly, from one family. And another incident, 18 people killed, we think, when a public celebration was bombed in Mosul. One of those incidents was self-reported by the Danish military. We're encouraged by that. It's the first time any of these coalition members have publicly said, by the way, we think we may have killed or injured civilians. They did that just after an event on August the 30th, and that's an investigation that's still going on. So lots of change, lots of movement, lots of bombs.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. You bring up Denmark. Did they have in their parliament some kind of declaration of war against the Islamic State, or they're just... it's under the NATO charter or whatever. I mean, the Islamic State hadn't attacked the United States, so I don't think the U.S. invoked the NATO charter, did they? I think Turkey tried to, but against Assad or something. under what legality are all, and what all different countries are in there anyway?
So we've had 13 countries in. In fact, Denmark's pulling out on October the 1st. Belgium has already left the coalition. But it's almost a sort of airstrike musical chairs. We've got Turkey coming in at the moment. And, of course, independently of everybody, it looks like we'll have Russian jets coming in to bomb ISIL and defend Assad later this month. The skies above Syria in particular are getting very dangerous. And in fact, the coalition, John Kerry, State Department, warned Russia just last week there was a risk of conflict with the coalition. So the idea of a Russian coalition war over Syria is really what we don't need at the moment. So the countries that we have the UK, the United States, obviously, France, Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Australia, Canada, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Jordan. And Turkey has just come in the last few weeks. So it's a big spread of countries. they all go in for different reasons. Some have voted in their national parliaments to engage, but on other occasions they don't at all. Australia announced it's about to start carrying out airstrikes in Syria. They've been bombing in Iraq for the last year, but they're now moving across to Syria. They did not consult their parliament. That's caused quite a bit of upset across Australia. So each country's in there fighting for slightly different reasons. They're all there to defeat Islamic State, they say, but under different rules of engagement, using different aircraft, none of them formally under any UN or NATO rule book. So it's a very complicated business. It's really, if you like, an ad hoc alliance of 13 members, nominally under a couple of UN resolutions that call on the international community to defeat Islamic State.
Yeah. Well, at least there's a little bit of humor in the fact that the Americans are incensed that the Russians want to go and do what ostensibly the Americans are doing themselves, fighting the Islamic State. Only the Russians will say it's for Assad and the Americans insist still on regime-changing Assad. But they got the same enemy here. So it's only America's insane policy of still trying to debothify the government in Damascus after all these years that put us in conflict with the Russians on this at all. You'd think they'd be inviting the Russians into NATO and say, let's all go bomb the Islamic State together, you know?
I think that the horror that the State Department has is if somehow by this Russian intervention the Assad regime survives. And just to be clear, you know, Islamic State is a horrific terror-based organization, but the number of civilians it's killed in Iraq and Syria is a fraction of the civilians butchered by Assad. Assad deliberately targets civilians in rebel-held areas. That's not just areas held by Islamic State, but also Nusra Front, the Free Syrian Army, the Kurds, and so on. Thousands and thousands and thousands of Syrians have died as a result of the Assad regime's airstrikes. So I can understand State being concerned about Russia bolstering Assad or keeping him in power longer. But this is the problem. You know, we are players in a five or even six way civil war in Syria right now. And it's never been clear to me what our overall aim is. By defeating Islamic State, we may guarantee the victory of the Nusra Front, which of course is the local Al-Qaeda affiliate, or even the Assad regime. I just don't understand how that makes military sense. And what we never hear, of course, Scott, is about civilians on the ground. We never hear about peace. We never hear about the plan to stop this fighting. It's always about the bombs, always about the war.
Yeah, of course. Well, and when it comes to civilian casualties, airstrikes aside, if the regime falls, I mean, I don't know about Assad, this or that. Of course, there's a new report out today about how the Russians offered to get rid of Assad back in 2012, and the Americans said no. They'd rather have a war, I guess. That's in The Guardian today. But if his regime falls, then that'll just be the start of the civilian casualty count when it comes to the crucifixions and beheadings and suicide bombings and the rest of the war that the jihadists would bring to all the Shia, the Druze, the Christians, and even the vast numbers of Sunnis that still support the regime.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you have to take Assad out of the equation and realize that there are 40% of Syrians who are from a position against those who've risen up against Assad. It's 40% of the entire remaining population. Really, the whole area around Latakia, most of Aleppo, millions of people. And, you know, Al Jazeera has had chat shows where the host has talked about genocide against these people, as if this is something entirely natural to discuss. One of the most shocking things I've ever seen on TV. Some of the more radical Islamist groups openly discuss, as you say, how they will behead and crucify the civilians in this area. So whether you like Assad or not, he is helping to preserve the lives of those people at the moment. And if Assad falls, as you say, Scott, what we're seeing now could just be a fraction of the deaths to come. It is a terrible, terrible situation.
And I don't want anybody to misunderstand me here, like I support Assad or think the U.S. government should support Assad or anything, but we sure as hell shouldn't be backing the rebels against him and shouldn't have been the last 4 years. I mean, truth, I mean, you're correct about the civilians, his military slaughters. But this war would have been over in 2011 if America, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar, and Israel weren't supporting the bin Ladenite head chopper crazies this whole time. And so now we're in this position where, you know, the war would have been over You know, now we got a couple hundred thousand killed at least, and maybe many more than that coming up. And we got to go to break. But when we get back, more on the air wars with Chris Woods from airwars.org.
Hey, Al Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism vs. Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism vs. Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Radio Network. Noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. I'm talking with Chris Woods from airwars.org. They've got their new report out for August, Coalition Strikes and Civilian Casualty Claims in Iraq and Syria, August 2015. And, man, there's so many different things to talk about here, Chris. I want to ask you partially about the what you know of or what you have heard, what you think of. What's the basis for the intelligence that is being used for the targeting here? Because a bunch of planes, I mean, even drones are basically deaf, blind, and stupid up there in the air flying around with a bird's eye view and don't know anything. And F-16 going, you know, half a Mach or whatever. They're even less capable than that and flying at even higher altitudes. So, and I don't think, I mean, there have been some, obviously there's special forces embedded with the Kurds or whatever, but we're talking about airstrikes in Mosul and Ramadi and Fallujah, where there are not reported to be any American special forces or spies with laser pointers. And I wonder who you think is telling them, here's who you need to bomb.
It depends really where we're talking about the airstrikes. So in northern Syria at the moment, for example, there's a major Peshmerga offensive. The YPK on that side of the border, they've captured a lot of territory across northern Syria since they broke out of the siege of Kobani earlier this year. So many of those airstrikes are guided in by the Peshmerga on the ground, just as the Peshmerga across the border in Iraq, guide in airstrikes, and there's a major Iraq army offensive going on around the city of Tuz in Iraq at the moment. That, again, will have more traditional ground spotters calling in those strikes. The rest of the strikes, as you say, Scott, Mosul, Ramadi, Fallujah, Raqqa, Al-Hasaka, all of these cities and towns, the names we've come to know so well, those are strikes, they're targets of opportunity, or they're intelligence-led strikes. There is clearly human intelligence coming from the ground. I mean, the coalition is, without a doubt, taking out some of the senior leaders of ISIL in both Iraq and in Syria, often very targeted strikes on moving vehicles and so on, taking out named leaders. So it can't all be aerial only. There has to be human intelligence coming out. Bridges hit, operational bases destroyed, and so on. Other kinds of strikes, we have the planes roving around looking for targets. I think those kind of strikes are the ones that are most dangerous for civilians on the ground. We often see civilians caught up in those, killed by shrapnel, or a vehicle goes into the kill box at the last minute. And in fact, Air Wars published just last week, actually, with major international media partners. We were given a declassified CENTCOM document which showed how CENTCOM had investigated 45 alleged incidents of civilian casualties in this air war. Sadly, it had dismissed almost all of them within 24 to 48 hours without really properly investigating them. But what that did show is that in a quarter of those cases, they've been internally reported by the coalition itself. So this was pilots, navigators, intelligence analysts internally saying, actually, we think there was a problem on this strike. We saw these two motorbikes come into the kill zone, or we're not quite sure if there was a child in this bunker. I mean, clearly the coalition takes it seriously, but the quality of the intelligence is still less than we would hope for. And one thing we track at Air Wars is the monthly data that CENTCOM releases on, in military terms, it's called ISR, Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance. This is the lifeblood of modern conflicts, aerial surveillance. This is how you decide what to target. And more than a year into the war, Iraq and Syria are still lagging way behind ISR provision in Afghanistan. Now, that may sound like a really technical term and a technical point, but when you've got no spotters on the ground, that ISR is vital. And we don't really understand why the coalition has got so little ISR in there, even a year on. We think part of the problem is the US military is stretched so thin now across so many theaters of conflict, and of course the US is the primary supplier of high-quality ISR, that it simply doesn't have the kit to go around. It's in Mali, it's in Libya, it's in Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, and God knows where else. So I think, you know, they're up against the buffers on this. And we saw, you know, just a few weeks ago, the Pentagon announcing it was doubling again the U.S. drone fleet. I think that's entirely what this is about. You know, it's creeping
at the seams.
Is that what
they said? I missed that. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to double again the number of. It's up by 50%. So it will go from 60 drones that can be simultaneously fielded in any 1 hour up to 90. So it's a 50% boost up to 90 caps. But that actually is there's 4 or 5 drones for each of those combat air patrols. So
that's only including the Reapers and the Predators. That's not necessarily all the millions of other kinds, right?
Exactly. That's just armed drones. Yeah. And it's a complicated war, this, and it's being fought on lots of different fronts in lots of different ways. Some of it quite traditional, troops on the ground. Other parts of it, intelligence-driven strikes. And then you have this third layer, which is targets of opportunity. And in fact, the UK Guardian reported just a few weeks ago that 90% of the strikes in total were actually targets of opportunity across Iraq and Syria. That is challenging stuff.
Yeah. Well, and so I wonder, you know, you have the list of at least the admitted strikes that they do, airstrikes that they do, that CENTCOM publishes and all that. And I guess your task is really to try to correlate that with whatever other information you can get coming out of Iraq and Syria about those same strikes and see if you can, you know, find much information. But there's very little reporting going on out of the Islamic State right now, right? So how difficult is it for you to pin down how many civilians killed are we really talking about here? It sounds like when we're talking tens of civilians in thousands of strikes, that doesn't seem right.
Well, it's interesting. In Syria, we have a much easier job. And part of the reason is that when the Arab Spring happened and then the civil war broke out a year later, monitoring groups inside Syria sprang up to record the casualties of the civil war. And then when ISIL appeared, when Islamic State appeared, they just added ISIL to that list. And then when the coalition came along and started bombing in Syria, they just added us to the list. So we just became another belligerent whose bombings were being measured. So the reporting, even in cities like Raqqa, al-Hasakah, is not bad, actually. There are groups in there risking their lives to get this information out, not just, of course, about those killed by Islamic State, but also by the Assad regime and by Daesh themselves. So the quality of information from Syria is, we find, much better. We've named in our data, which is culled often from these monitoring organizations, we've named in our own data, I think about 320 of the civilians reported killed. That's helpful because, of course, when you name a civilian, you get biographical details, photos, and so on. It's no longer a statistic. It's also much harder to fake an actual named person.
And I'm sorry I said tens when I, you know, clearly we're talking hundreds and hundreds.
We are talking hundreds, absolutely. Our minimum estimate is that at least 550 civilians have been killed by the coalition in Iraq and Syria to the end of August. That's still a fraction of the civilians killed by the Assad regime. And to come back to your point, how accurate can these be and so on? What's bizarre about the war in Syria in particular is it's almost like we have an old style air war and a modern air war running side by side. Often the coalition and Assad will bomb the same cities on the same day. One using indiscriminate barrel bombing and fuel air bombs and so on, the other using more precise weapons. And certainly what we hear from the ground is that those coalition bombs are causing far fewer civilian casualties. But they're not causing zero civilian casualties, which of course is the line that the coalition is pretty much pushing still. The coalition still only admits to 2 likely civilian casualties in more than a year of bombing. Absurd, of course, absolutely absurd. And frankly insulting, not just to Iraqis and Syrians, who know the reality, but also to Americans, Brits, Australians, who were expected to believe this guff.
But it's, now, Chris, really so the hard math and the numbers aside here, I'm just asking, on the record here, but not your science and your journalism, but your knowledge and your wisdom and your gut feeling about what's going on here. Do you think that 500 is probably pretty low, but you just can't show any higher than that? Or you think that that's really about right?
We can only go on the evidence that we have. We can't, we get criticized for being low. Our response to that can only be, we have researchers, Arabic researchers, Syrian researchers, Iraqi researchers, scouring media, scouring social media, talking to people, trying to find every claim and then assess it. So we're finding as much as we can. We can't invent this stuff.
Yeah.
So the numbers are telling us, 500 minimum. But then having said that, when that CENTCOM report came into our hands a few weeks ago, a quarter of those cases had never been publicly reported. So there are bound to be cases we're not aware of. And there are vested interests on all sides here wanting to play down these civilian casualties or play them up, depending on the faction. So it's very difficult, but we think it's worth doing.
Yeah, well, it's incredible journalism and another spectacular interview. Thank you very much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's Chris Woods. He's at airwars.org. His book is Sudden Justice, and you can also find a tremendous archive at the Bureau for Investigative Journalism. We'll be right back.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Hey, how's it going? Oops. All right, now I'm live. I gotta stop typing. All right, hey, I'm Scott. It's my show. Hey, check it out. So, I mentioned this thing, but I better talk about it to you here, and maybe even just, let's just read it together, boys and girls. Julian Borger. Good reporter from The Guardian. Whoa, I gotta turn that down, don't I? The Spies Who Pushed for War. That's a great one by Julian Borger. Ever read it? You might want to read it. The Spies Who Pushed for War. But anyway, this one is not a decade old. It's called West Ignored Russian Offer in 2012 to Have Syria's Assad Step Aside. Oh my goodness. Senior negotiator describes rejection of alleged proposal, since which time tens of thousands, try hundreds, have been killed and millions displaced. Wow, man. Russia proposed more than 3 years ago that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad could step down as part of a peace deal, according to a senior negotiator involved in back-channel discussions at the time, former Finnish president and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Martti Ahtisaari, said Western powers failed to seize on the proposal. Since it was made in 2012, tens of thousands of people have been killed and millions uprooted, causing the world's gravest refugee crisis since the Second World War. Ahtisaari held talks with envoys from the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in February 2012. February! The beginning of 2012, man. He said that during those discussions, the Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churchkin, laid out a three-point plan which included a proposal for Assad to cede power at some point after peace talks had started. After, I guess, is the key word, needing the emphasis there. Assad would cede power at some point after peace talks had started between the regime and the opposition. But he said that the U.S., Britain, and France were so convinced that the Syrian dictator was about to fall, they ignored the proposal. Wow. That's a year and a half before Turkey and Al-Qaeda's false flag sarin attack that almost got America to bomb Damascus, to fly in there and finish the regime change. They could have ended this war before Al-Qaeda ever even took root there. I mean, you had some Syrian Al-Qaeda guys, but they didn't have a revolution going on. They filled up a power vacuum. And then they were backed with money and guns by the USA. And America's sock puppets, or is it the other way around? Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, and Israel. Ain't that something? In 2012, Obama said, Assad must step aside. He said that in the summer of 2012. He had an offer to get rid of Assad in February. And look, the Russians, if they told Assad, listen, we're the bosses of you and you're done and you're going to put the next guy, you know, in line up there and we're going to negotiate. He's going to do what they say. He has to. He's completely dependent on them. Well, I don't know completely, but he's very much reliant on them. And, oh no, but that's poison, right? Can't work with the Russians on anything. It's better to have a nuclear war with the Russians than it is to work with them on a peace deal. The most intriguing was the meeting I had with Vitaly Churchkin, because I know this guy, Ahtisaari recalled. We don't necessarily agree on many issues, but we can talk candidly. I explained what I was doing there, and he said, Marty, sit down, and I'll tell you what we should do. He said three things. One, we should not give arms to the opposition. Two, we should get a dialogue going between the opposition and Assad straight away. Three, we should find an elegant way for Assad to step aside. Churchkin declined to comment on what he said, saying it was a private conversation with Ahtisaari. The Finnish former president, however, was adamant about the nature of the discussion. There was no question because I went back and asked him a second time, he said, noting that Churchkin had just returned from a trip to Moscow, and there seemed little doubt he was raising the proposal on behalf of the Kremlin. This was not small talk over drinks, guys, right? Is what they're saying here. Ahtisaari said he passed on the message to the American, British, and French missions at the UN. But, he said, nothing happened. Because I think all these and many others were convinced that Assad would be thrown out of office in a few weeks. There was no need to do anything. While Ahtisaari was still in New York. Yeah, you know, that probably really is right. That they just thought, well, if there's momentum on the side of the rebellion, well, that's just it. It's beyond their imagination to just imagine the next step. Hey, maybe the people threatened by the rebellion are going to double down now. Maybe they're going to ask their outside allied powers, like Iran and Hezbollah, for support. And they were, you know, the Saudis were already sending Mujahideen to Syria in 2011, but still, I mean, if they had had some kind of negotiation there, it seems very plausible that the sovereignty of the Syrian state could have remained and prevented al-Qaeda from taking root there anywhere. They really haven't had a problem with jihadists in Syria. I mean, until 2011 and America's intervention there. They haven't had a problem like that since Assad's father massacred 20,000 in an attack on the Muslim Brotherhood back in, I think, the late 1980s, 88 or something like that. Eric Margolis was there. He was right down the road when it happened, reporting on it. And but they haven't really had a problem with the jihadists since then. The only thing they had to do with jihadists since then was George Bush would send, and oh, sorry, Bill Clinton and George Bush would send terrorists to Assad to be murdered, to be tortured and killed. He worked for America. Now, he was not outright, you know, an American sock puppet like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt or something like that. He's obviously closer to Iran and Russia and not in America's axis, but he was cooperative with the world empire, no question. And Bush sent him guys to torture all day long for 8 years. Obama came in and overthrew him on behalf of those he was torturing, the bin Ladenites. Oh, and some innocent people thrown in there as well. I'm not saying it was fair or just or right. I'm just saying, describing who's on whose side here for you. And so, I mean, just think of what a crime this is. Is there going to be any accountability for this? Of course not, because the president's opposite party in Washington, D.C., they're even worse than him on this issue. So this might not even make the New York Times. This might not even make the news that Russia had a proposal to thwart the war, to undermine and end the war back at the beginning of 2012. That's a lot of suicide attacks ago. That's a lot of people crucified to death. That's the rise of the Islamic State. Yeah, that Barack Obama, at least he's not a Republican, right? But you gotta admit, you really are that much worse than him on all this shit.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commodity discs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Still tons of news to cover for you here. Taliban storm key Afghan prison, freeing 355 inmates. Most escapees were Taliban. But otherwise, you know, we won that war and it's over. And even though there are still 10,000 American soldiers there, plus mercs, plus spies, plus another, I think, 10,000 NATO, various other European forces there as well. So not only is the Afghan war not over, but it ain't going well at all. strange thing politically, not very strange, pretty obvious actually, is nobody even cared about the Iraq war for the last 6 years. Other than, you know, people who really care about that stuff, but I just mean, you know, kind of in a nationwide sense. The people leaning left decided they didn't want to pay attention to it, care about it, know about it, because it was their man Obama was doing it. And so they just basically ignored it when they weren't, you know, making arguments for the surge and whatever, trying to back up the president. They mostly just ignored it. Afghanistan, you know, if it was a George Bush war still, they would hate it still, but it's not, so they don't. And of course, Republicans, not all of them, again, other than those who really are into this stuff and really good on it, generally speaking, the right-wingers, they love war. They love bombing Afghanistan. They don't care if the Afghan war ever ends. Did you guys see there's that military satire site? It's like The Onion. I hate to say that because The Onion's not funny anymore, but it's like The Onion for military guys. It's called The Duffel Blog. And it says, man who said he was going to war back in 2001, quote, so his son wouldn't have to, really feels like an asshole right now. It's about how he's over there occupying Afghanistan and his son is in another division 20 miles away. They made no progress whatsoever. Anyway. I don't know what's going to happen there, man. Them Talibs, they don't quit. And I guess they're still backed by the Pakistanis because it's in the Pakistanis' interest to keep the Indian-allied others at least, you know, off balance if they can't drive them all the way out of power. So, same terrible song. Years and years later, still playing. But yeah, that surge, man, accomplished absolutely nothing. Barack Obama completely rolled by the military back in 2009. Petraeus and McChrystal calling him a wimp, basically. And instead of being tough and standing up to them and just being honest with the American people and saying, look, do you really believe the war in Afghanistan can be won short of just wiping out every Pashtun fighting age male over there? Then shut up. We're done. You can call it a victory or you can call it a defeat. We're leaving. And instead, he proved how tough he was by cowering before tougher men and letting them lose another war, letting them have another surge, letting them add time to the Washington clock, as Petraeus put it, so they could wage the war for another 3 years, send another 90,000 guys over there to still lose. Only get that many more people killed. And remember, the deal was, David Petraeus, he promises that by July 2011, we'll have beaten on the Taliban so bad, their nose will be so bloody, that they're gonna beg to come to the table for our peace terms. That was how it was sold. It wasn't even sold like, yeah, we will defeat them and they will sign whatever we tell them to sign. It was, well, you know, we're gonna bloody their nose real bad and they're gonna not like that. And then they're gonna sign what we want them to sign. And that's gonna mean anything anyway. That was the sales job. And based on that, they sold an extra 3 years of war and an extra 100,000 guys and 90,000, something. A few tens of thousands more casualties and no progress whatsoever. Biggest white elephant embarrassment war ever. And I guess it'll never end. I wonder if the day I die, America will still be in Afghanistan. I guess probably so. No telling, you know, how long I'll get to live, I guess. But it'd be nice to ever see the end of the American occupation of Central Asia, I think. You can read Alfred McCoy on Tom Dispatch today. It'll be on antiwar.com tomorrow. Not he's saying this, but he's just analyzing the American imperialist. We have to rule the world island. We have to control Eastern Europe and Central Asia to prevent any other power bloc, read Russia or China, from ruling it. And why? Because preeminence. That's why. Would you have our preeminence taken away? What if we weren't preeminent? Now, I know you're asking, but who cares who rules the steppes of Central Asia? Who cares who's preeminent in Central Asia? And I say to you, you must not be a government employee then. Or you must not be a very politically connected oil baron. Because, generally speaking, all of humanity benefits from the development of economic resources in Asia, silly. The richer the Russians get, the richer the Chinese get, the richer the Poles and the Ukrainians and the Hungarians get, the richer humanity is, the better off we all are. How can that be a threat to anyone unless you're a politician? Unless you're some kind of nationalist like Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, who thinks that America is some collective organism and needs strong leadership so that we can compete against and win as America, a single unit, win against the rest of humanity. This is madness. This is what a lot of really smart people convince themselves is true. But think about it from the point of view of, you know, just you in your town, living your life, working at a private business, maybe trying to run one of your own. You think you gain from the American empire? I mean, possibly if you're outsourcing all your manufacturing, you're gaining from the subsidy of the Navy protecting, you know, providing all your security on the high seas, that kind of thing. Again, you can pick and choose particular industries might benefit. But America as a whole benefits from preventing Russia, China, Europe, the stands from integrating their ability to produce and distribute? No. Of course not. That's crazy.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here's how to help support The Scott Horton Show. You go to scotthorton.org/donate and donate whatever you want. A penny or a dollar or $5 or $10 or $20 or whatever you think is a good amount. No problem. Or you can sign up for a monthly donation for whatever those same amounts, all the way up to $1 million a month or whatever you think is appropriate. There's really no limit on that. Could be above $1 million. If you donate, and there's also Patreon.com. Man, I really should talk about this more. This is a good way for you to incentivize me to shut up and do better work arranging interviews for the show. Because over there you get charged per interview that I deliver. So you sign up, give 25 cents or 50 cents or a dollar or a dime or whatever you think is appropriate. And all that helps add up too. Patreon.com/Scott Horton Show there. Anybody donates $100, you get a 1 ounce silver coin, or you get Lou Rockwell's audiobook of Fascism versus Capitalism narrated by me, or you get the actual book of Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman. Red, Blue, and Broke All Over by Charles Goyette. He's a great Austrian. You'll really like it. Great book. And, and there's another one, Beyond Democracy, that is another audiobook narrated by the great Jeff Riggenbach, which you could also get if you donate $100 to the show. You get to choose from those things. Anyone who donates $200, hey, that's a lot of money, I know, but check it out. If you donate $200 to help support this show, then you get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've already done, I think, a couple of dozen libertarian audiobooks, including the one by Lou Rockwell that I narrated. They've already done, I think, a couple of dozen, and they plan on doing hundreds more there. Lifetime subscription to libertarian audiobooks at listenandthink.com, or from listenandthink.com, I should say, if you donate $200 to this show, to support this show. A very generous offer by Derek Sheriff there at Listen and Think Audio. I do hope you'll take him up on it, because wouldn't that be nice? All right, cool. Now back to the news, but, you know, I thought you should know. It could be worse. This could be National Public Radio or something. Okay. So we talked about the imperialism and the thing. You know, there was one more thing I was going to say about that, but now I don't remember what it was. Afghanistan. Oh, I know what it was. It was speaking of Ukraine. Yes, America must dominate Ukraine. Because. Nobody can say why unless you are an investor in Archer Daniels Midland. Or you're going to cash in on IMF debt somehow. How is this in the interest of the American people whatsoever? I don't know. But then we're at the level of such absurdity now, I think that, you know, I don't know. It's either going to end with a thermonuclear exchange or everybody's going to die laughing. Ukraine president under pressure to install Saakashvili as the new prime minister. What? How in the world do they figure seriously that they're going to put Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, in as prime minister of Ukraine, especially when
the Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here. Especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister, and you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats, and I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario, and I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know.
All right, that was the clip I wanted to play. I think Yats is the guy. All right, so that's Newland Ukraine 2. I thought it was Newland Ukraine 1. They're getting rid of Yats? But how can they get rid of Yats when...
I think Yats is the guy.
When Victoria Nuland, Robert Kagan's wife, thinks that...
I think Yats is the guy.
So they're going to get rid of Yats. And now they want to put in Mikhail Saakashvili, this lunatic who tried to get America into a war with Russia back in August of 2008. Did you see this? Did you hear about this? Do you remember back then? Oh, back in history in 2008. So here's how it goes. Georgia, of course, is in between the Black and Caspian Seas at the, south of the Caucasus Mountains there, right? And so there's this little breakaway province of Georgia called South Ossetia and another one called Abkhazia, which is a little bit further west than there on the Black Sea. But so they had this autonomy deal kind of worked out that was brokered by the European Union with American blessing, of course. That had Russian peacekeepers occupying as invited guests of the Ossetians, and again, with the assent of the Americans and the EU, They had so-called peacekeeping troops there in Georgia. In Ossetia, I'm sorry, to keep the Georgians out, is what I'm trying to tell you. And in August of 2008, Saakashvili just invaded South Ossetia and attacked the Russian peacekeepers straight away, killed hundreds of civilians in just over one night. Quite a few hundred people were killed, I believe. Near 1,000. And then the Russians came through the tunnels under the mountains. Isn't that cool? They got tunnels under the entire Caucasus Mountains? That's really something else, man. Anyway, they came through the tunnels under the mountains and over the top of them, too, in their planes and their helicopters. And, of course, they crushed the Georgians in a matter of a couple of days and drove them back out of South Ossetia. And at the time, and this has been recorded, reported by, I think, at least two different journalists working off of multiple sources each, that Dick Cheney, I think even George Bush himself told this story at one point or something, now that I think about it. Anyway, it's at least well reported. I'm 90% sure Ron Suskind is one who reported that Dick Cheney pushed George W. Bush to attack the tunnels, to collapse the tunnels, and kill the Russians coming through the tunnels under the mountains. Strikes on the Russians coming into South Ossetia. Again, where America had assented to Europe's deal with the Russians, that they would have peacekeepers there to keep Georgia from occupying the place, even though it was still technically Georgia, the previous compromise position. And apparently Bush turned to the rest of the cabinet and said, "Who agrees with the vice president that we should attack the Russians?" And the rest of the war cabinet sat there and was like, "What are we talking about here?" Again, this is 2008. This is when Bush has 3 months left here. And so he says, "Yeah, well, thanks, Mr. Cheney, but okay, next." Yeah, I guess you'd be upset, too, if you trusted somebody and then they had you going down in history as the worst president ever. As bad as Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt. I would be. But anyway, so now they want to make Saakashvili, first of all, they made him the mayor of Odessa in Ukraine. Really? All right. And then now they want to bring him in to be the prime minister? You've got to be kidding me. Oh, well. I don't know, man. People say India, Pakistan over Kashmir, but I think this is the hottest flashpoint in the world right now. At least it's a hell of one, and it has the potential to be hotter than any flashpoint. Hotter than any temperature in this quadrant of our galaxy, actually. No, really, hotter than our sun. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys. Thanks for hanging in there with me. Wrapping up the show for the day. I'm Scott Horton here complaining about the empire. It's really bad, you know? I don't know. How you like this? Egyptian military attacks Mexican tourists. Barbecue. Killing 12. Tourism chairman. They didn't have a permit. are we like the Egyptians, or the Egyptians are more like us, or how can you tell them apart at this point? That's part of being the empire, man. Staring into the abyss. Stares back into you. Egyptian military junta. Sorry. The Egyptian military junta routinely carries out airstrikes in the western desert without any indication of who they've killed. Writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Today, however, the most recent of the airstrikes ended up causing something of an international incident when it turned out they'd attacked a group of Mexican tourists and their Egyptian guides, killing 12 and wounding many more. The tourists were stopped by the side of the road having a barbecue when, in what is described as a joint military police and armed forces operation, Egypt launched several airstrikes against them. The Interior Ministry referred to them as being mistakenly dealt with. Not that they're apologizing or anything. They didn't have a permit. And then later it turns out that they admit that, yeah, they did have a permit. Sorry about that. Anyway. Yeah, it won't be long before that's going on in Arizona and Texas and New Mexico on a regular basis. Are you going to try to cross here, huh? Hellfire missile. All right, then Bahrain. Bahrain rights remain a serious concern for 32 nations. This is from the Agence France-Presse. 32 countries on Monday raised the alarm over the human rights situation in Bahrain, urging Manama to investigate reports of torture and other abuses and to bring the perpetrators to justice. The human rights situation in Bahrain remains an issue of serious concern to us, Swiss Ambassador Alexander Fessel said, speaking on behalf of the 32 countries, including the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany. Really, the U.S. bothered chiming in, huh? Well, I'm sure there's audio somewhere of Obama telling him, hey, you know, we're just playing, but pro wrestling style and whatever, we got to pretend for political reasons. But seriously, go on and do whatever you feel like doing to whoever you feel like. That's the law in America, in our empire. Oh, did you not know that Bahrain was wholly owned by the United States? Yeah, well, see, they let us keep the Fifth Fleet station there. And so we let them be a little kingdom and let a very tiny percentage of the population rule everyone else in a, you know, kingdom. Because that's what America does. We spread dictatorship around the world. Oh, and sometimes violent jihadist revolution against them too, when the dictatorships don't belong to us enough. I admit that. But otherwise, hey, if you got a king, an emir, a sultan, a president in olive green, somewhere we got dollars going to him. Guaranteed. All right, anyway, so, yeah, well, of course there's human rights problems there. The people had no rights at all. I mean, they're born naturally free, of course, but the government doesn't respect their rights at all. That's what I mean to say. It's a 70% supermajority of Shia ruled by a tiny Sunni minority sect backed by the U.S. and backed by Saudi. But then, oh no, America says, hey, Bahrain, lighten up a little bit by signing on to some PR stunt with the Germans or what have you. But do they actually counsel their pet dictatorship that, hey, stop maintaining your dictatorship and its power and authority here? No. In fact, what a funny coincidence. Right at the top of this story I'm reading at Yahoo News right now, it says former Meet the Press moderator David Gregory joins Yahoo News Live. Oh, he got a job on the internet now, huh? That's nice. Welcome to the big leagues, David. And so here's what's a funny coincidence about that. When the Arab Spring broke out in 2011, David Gregory was hosting Meet the Press. And David Gregory was interviewing Admiral Mike Mullen and saying, so, we're overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, huh? And Mullen saying, oh yeah, gotta get rid of that Gaddafi. He's a bad guy. You know what? Just like Koresh or Saddam or whoever. Bad guy. Bad weapons, bad to his own people, too crazy to deal with, and so we've got to go ahead and bomb them to death. Call it the Davidian Doctrine. Not that it was theirs, but for use on them. And David Gregory says, I see. Well, how can we support the dictatorship in Bahrain? The kingdom there that's ruthlessly oppressing the people who are protesting in the Pearl Roundabout. And Admiral Mike Mullen said, because Bahrain is our ally. Bahrain is our ally. And what's funny is American nationalists, they hear stuff like that, and they can switch from, oh, America, democracy and love and freedom and human rights, to, yeah, well, damn right. Screw them Bahrainians. We can support a dictator over them if we feel like it, because we're exceptional and blah, blah, blah. That's the same reason we invaded Iraq, because we love them so much. And if you didn't support that war, it's because you didn't care about the Iraqi people enough to save them from Saddam. You selfish coward. But so what's the difference between overthrowing Gaddafi and backing the dictatorship in Bahrain? Well, the dictatorship in Bahrain is more compliant. Gaddafi, yeah, it's true. He made a deal with Bush, and Bush brought him in from the cold. Oh, just what, 7 years before. You know, he was still the wacky colonel and wasn't quite cooperative enough. And the Europeans, they wanted to overthrow him, and we like bombing stuff. And Hillary says it'll make us look like we're really nice guys. Not that everyone in the region knows for a fact that we backed their local dictator. No, they'll be very confused and say, hooray, America, coming to take the side of the protesters against the evil dictator. Only in this case, the protesters were Al-Qaeda guys, Libyan veterans of the war, the last war in Iraq. I know, it's hard to tell which one. Iraq War II, I meant. It was the most recent Iraq war at the time. It helped lead to the next Iraq war, the one going on now. But anyway, we think the price is worth it, that kind of thing. And then Yemen. The UN says U.S. drone strikes in Yemen have killed more civilians than Al-Qaeda. Yeah, well, check this out. Saudi airstrikes killed 10 civilians in North Yemen capital. Saudi airstrikes taking heavy toll on Yemeni civilians. U.S. drone strike destroys car in North Yemen, killing four. Pro-Saudi forces claim gains in Yemen's Marib, vow to move on Sana'a. These are all from news.antiwar.com. And isn't it on antiwar.com today? Or wait, let me check the page here. There's one. Yeah, here. This is the quote. To run tomorrow on antiwar.com. Yemen after 5 months looks like Syria after 5 years. As Yemen rapidly disintegrates, the U.S. is turning a blind eye to atrocities committed by its Saudi allies, even as Washington enables them. And by enables, he means really enables. Not, of course, we're friends with Saudi and sold them weapons, but we keep shipping them weapons. And, of course, it's Americans who are running the whole war. It's Americans who are picking the targets and sending these pilots to them. And the LA Times reported just a couple of weeks ago that they were sending more people to help. I mean, hey, they didn't just agree with the Saudis that go ahead and bomb them and we'll see what happens. Apparently they agreed with the Saudis that you can go ahead and we will support a full-scale invasion, and by any other members of the GCC and whoever else you can bring in, the Egyptians or whoever, and go ahead and overthrow the... Again, these are all satellites of the American empire. This is all up to America, and it's all because Obama has ordered our military to help them do it, or it wouldn't be happening at all. So it is up to him. Him. And them. The U.S. government. And but they've promised, go ahead, overthrow as long as it takes, do whatever it takes to get rid of Hadi, apparently, is what Obama's told them.